got on white socks under flesh-colored huaraches, and ancient, baggy, old, birch-colored sweatpants with B-U-M down one leg, which Gately's pretty sure he's seen at the Sunday a.m. Big Book meeting on Ken Urdetti, and belong to Urdetti, and he feels a flash of something unpleasant that she'd be wearing the upscale kid's pants. The a.m. light outside has gone from sunny yellow-white to now a kind of old dime gray, with what looks like serious wind. Joelle eats the cream cheese brownies Gately can't eat, and works at pulling a kind of big notebookish thing out of her broadcloth purse. She talks about last night's St. Columbkill's meeting,
348,
where they'd all gone unsupervised because Jeanette F. had to stay and keep an eye on Glynn, who was sick, and on Henderson and Willis, who were under legal quarantine upstairs. Gately racks his RAM for which fucking night St. Columbkill's is. Joelle says how last night's was St. Collie's once-a-month format, where instead of a commitment, they had that round-robin discussion where somebody in the hall spoke for 5 minutes and then picked the next speaker out of the hall's crowd. There'd been a Kentuckian there, which Gately might recall she was from Kentucky. A Kentucky newcomer there, Wayne something, a real damaged-looking boy who hailed from the good old bluegrass state, but of late resided in a disconnected drainage pipe off a watershed facility down in the Alston Spur, he'd said. This guy, she said he was 19 or thereabout, looked 40-some plus, had clothes that looked to be decomposing on him even as he stood at the podium, had a ripe odor of drainage about him that produced hankies as far back as the fourth row, which he explained the odor by admitting his residential drainage pipe was in fact mostly disconnected, like as in little used. Joelle's voice is nothing like the hollow resonant radio voice, and she uses her hands a lot to talk, trying to recreate the whole thing for Gately. Trying to give him a little bit of a meeting, Gately realizes, with a slight, tight smile of disbelief that he can't dredge up a mental meeting schedule so he'll know what day this is. Some of the St. Columbkillers were saying it was the longest single blackout they'd ever heard of. This Wayne fella'd said he'd had no idea when, why, or how he'd ended up so far up north as Metro Boston 10 years after his last memory. Most compelling, visually, Wayne had had a deep diagonal furrow in his face, extending from right eyebrow to left lip corner. Joelle traces the length and angle with a ragged nailed finger across her veil, splaying his nose and upper lip and rendering him so violently cross-eyed he seemed to address both corners of the front row at the same time. This old Wayne Boyd sketched how the facial dent, what Wayne had called the flaw, pointing at it like people might need help seeing what he was talking about, derived from his very own personal hard-drinking, alcoholic, and chicken farmer daddy, in the grip of the post-binge horrors, and seeing subjective pests in a big way one day, up and hitting Wayne at age 9, smack in the face with a hatchet one time, when Wayne couldn't tell him where a certain ball jar of distilled spirits had been hidden the day before, against the possibility of the horrors. It had been just him and his daddy and his ma, that was feeble, and 7.7 acres of chicken farm, Wayne had said. Wayne said the flaw had just about healed up fine with fresh air and plenty of exercise when his daddy, trying one Monday p.m. to get outside a late lunch of mush and syrup, up and clutched his skull, turned red, and then blue, and then purple, and died. Little Wayne had reportedly wiped the face clean of mush, dragged the dead body under the farmhouse porch, wrapped it in Purina chicken chow sacks, and told his feeble ma his daddy had gone off to lay up drunk. The diagonal-dented kid had apparently then got off to school, as usual, done some discreet WOM advertising, and had brought home with him a different set of boys each day for almost a week, charging them a fiveski ahead to crawl under the porch and eyeball a bona fide dead man. Late Friday p.m., he recollected, he'd set off with hard currency to the billiard establishment where the niggers that sold distilled ball jars to his late daddy was at.
349.
Getting set to lay up drunk as a cock on Jimson. the next thing this Wayne boy says he knows? He wakes up in the partially disconnected New England pipe, one millennial decade older, and with some right nasty medical issues the timer's bell prevents him from sharing in detail. And this old Wayne boy had up and pointed to Joel to come speak next. Almost as if he knew, as if he gut intuited some sort of kinship, affinity of origin. Gately grunted softly to himself. He figured guys with 10-year blackouts who live in pipes probably didn't have too much to go on besides your gut-type intuitions. He knew he needed to be reminded that this strange girl was only about 3 weeks clean, and still leaching substances out of her tissues, and still utterly clueless, but he felt like he resented it whenever he got reminded. Joelle had the big flat book in her lap and was looking down at her thumb and flexing it, watching it flex. What was disconcerting was that, when her head was down, the veil hung loose at the same vertical angle as when her head was up. Only now, it was perfectly smooth and untextured, a smooth, white screen with nothing behind it. A loudspeaker down the hall gave those xylophone dings that meant God knows what all the time. When Joelle's head came back up, the reassuring little hills and valleys of veiled features reappeared behind the screen.
"I'm going to have to take off here in a second," she said. "I could come on back after if you want. I can bring you anything you think you'd like."
Gately hiked an eyebrow at her to get her to smile.
"Hopefully since your fever went down, they said they'll decide you're out of the woods and take that out finally,"
Joelle said, looking at Gately's mouth.
"It's got to hurt, and Pat said you'll feel better when you can start, quote, sharing what you're feeling."
Gately hiked both eyebrows.
"And you can tell me what you'd like brought, who you'd want to have come, whom?"
Moving his left arm north along his chest and throat to get the left hand up to feel at his mouth made the whole right side sing with pain. A skin-warmed plastic tube led in from the right side and was taped to his right cheek and went into his mouth and went down his throat past where his fingers could feel at the back of his mouth. He hadn't been able to feel it in his mouth or going down the back of his throat to, he didn't want to know where, or even the tape on his cheek. He'd had, like, this, like, tube in his throat the whole time and hadn't even known it. It had been in there so long by the time he came up for air he'd gotten, like, unconsciously used to it and hadn't even known it was there. Maybe it was a feeding tube. The tube was probably why he could only mew and grunt. He probably didn't have permanent voice damage. Thank God. He made his thoughts capitalized and thanked God several times. He pictured himself at a lavish commitment podium, like at an AA convention, offhandedly saying something that got an enormous laugh. Either Joelle had some sort of problem with her thumb, or she just got really interested in watching the thumb flex and twiddle. She was saying,
"It's strange not knowing it's coming, then standing up there to speak. Folks you don't know. Things I don't realize I think till I say them. On the show I was used to knowing quite well what I thought before I spoke. This isn't like that."
She seemed to be addressing herself to the thumb.
"I took a page from your manual and shared my complaint about the but for the grace of God, and you were right, they just laughed. But I hadn't realized till I found myself telling them that I'd stopped seeing the one day at a time and keep it in the day as trite cliches. Patronizing."
Gately noticed she still talks about recovery issues in a stiff, proper, intellectualish way she doesn't talk about other stuff with. Her way of still keeping it all at arm's length a little. A mental thumb to pretend to look at while she talks. It was all right. Gately's own way of keeping it at arm's length at the start had involved an actual arm. He pictured her laughing as he tells her that, the veil billowing mightily in and out. He smiled around the tube, which Joelle saw as encouragement. She said,
"And why Pat in counseling keeps telling me just to build a wall around each individual 24-hour period and not look over or back and not to count days Even when you get a chip for 14 days or 30 days, not to add them up. In counseling, I just smile and nod, being polite. But standing up there last night, I didn't even share it aloud, but I realized suddenly that this was why I'd never been able to stay off the stuff for more than a couple weeks. I'd always break down, go back. Freebase. She looks up at him. I based, you know. You knew that. You all see the intake forms. Gately smiles. She said, this was why I couldn't get off and stay off, just as the cliche warns. I literally wasn't keeping it in the day. I was adding the clean days up in my head. She cocked her head at him. Did you ever hear of this fellow, Evel Knievel, this motorcycle jumper? Gately nods slightly, being careful of a tube he now feels. This is why his throat had had that raped feeling in it. The tube. He actually has an old cut-out action picture of the historical Evel Knievel from an old Life magazine and a white leather Elvis-ish suit in the air, aloft, haloed in spotlights, upright on a bike, a row of well-waxed trucks below. At St. Collie, only the crocodiles had heard of him. My own dad had followed him, cut out pictures, as a boy. Gately can tell she's smiling under there. But what I used to do, I throw away the pipe and shake my fist at the sky and say, as God is my fucking witness, never again, as of this minute right here, I quit for all time. She also has this habit of absently patting the top of her head when she talks, where little barrettes and spongy clamps hold the veil in place. And I'd bunker up, all white-knuckled, and stay straight, and count the days. I was proud of each day I stayed off. Each day seemed evidence of something. And I counted them. I'd add them up, line them up end to end, you know? Gately knows very well, but doesn't nod. Let her do this on just her own steam. She says, and soon it would get improbable. As if each day was a car Knievel had to clear. One car, two cars. By the time I'd get up to say, like maybe about 14 cars, they would begin to seem like this staggering number. Jumping over 14 cars. And the rest of the year, looking ahead, hundreds and hundreds of cars. Me, in the air, trying to clear them. She left her head alone and cocked it. Who could do it? How did I ever think anyone could do it that way? Gately remembered some evil fucking personal detoxes. Broke in Malden, bent with pleurisy in Salem, MCI Bill Ricca during a 4-day lockdown that caught him short. He remembered kicking the bird for weeks on the floor of a Revere holding cell, courtesy of the good old Revere assistant district attorney. Lockdown tight, a bucket for a toilet, the holding cell hot, but a terrible icy draft down near the floor. Cold turkey. Abrupt withdrawal. The bird. Being incapable of doing it and yet having to do it. Locked in. A Revere holding cage for 92 days. Feeling the edge of every second that went by. Taking it a second at a time. Drawing the time in around him real tight. Withdrawing. Any 1 second, he remembered, the thought of feeling like he'd be feeling this second for 60 more of these seconds, he couldn't deal. He could not fucking deal. He had to build a wall around each second just to take it. The whole first 2 weeks of it are telescoped in his memory down into like 1 second. Less the space between two heartbeats. A breath and a second. The pause and gather between each cramp. An endless now, stretching its gull wings out on either side of his heartbeat. And he'd never before or since felt so excruciatingly alive. Living in the present between pulses. What the white flaggers talk about, living completely in the moment. A whole day at a crack seemed like tit when he came in. For he had abided with the bird. But this interbeat present, this sense of endless now. It had vanished in Revere Holding, along with the heaves and chills. He'd returned to himself, moved to sit on the bunk's edge, and ceased to abide because he no longer had to. His right side is past standing, but the hurt is nothing like the bird's hurt was. He wonders sometimes if that's what ferocious Francis and the rest want him to walk toward, abiding again between heartbeats. Tries to imagine what kind of impossible leap it would take to live that way all the time, by choice, straight, in the second, the now, walled and contained between slow heartbeats. Ferocious Francis's own sponsor, the nearly dead guy they wheel to White Flag and call Sarge, says it all the time. It's a gift, the now. It's AA's real gift. It's no accident they call it the present. And yet it wasn't till that poor new pop fella from home pointed at me and hauled me up there, and I said it, that I realized, Joelle said, I don't have to do it that way. I get to choose how to do it, and they'll help me stick to the choice. I don't think I'd realized before that I could. I can really do this. I can do this for one endless day. I can, Don. The look he was giving her was meant to, like, validate her breakthrough and say, yes, yes, she could. She could as long as she continued to choose to. She was looking right at him, Gately could tell. But he'd also gotten a personal prickly chill all over from his own thinking. He could do the dextral pain the same way. Abiding. No one single instant of it was unendurable. Here was a second right here. He endured it. What was undealable with was the thought of all the instants, all lined up and stretching ahead, glittering, and the projected future fear of the assistant district attorney, whoever was out there in a hat eating third world fast food, the fear of getting convicted of nook slaughter, of VIP suffocation, of a lifetime on the edge of his bunk in MCI Walpole, remembering. It's too much to think about. To abide there. But none of it's as of now real. What's real is the tube, and noxema, and pain. And this could be done just like the old cold bird. He could just hunker down in the space between each heartbeat and make each heartbeat a wall and live in there. Not let his head look over. What's unendurable is what his own head could make of it all. What his head could report to him, looking over and ahead and reporting. But he could choose not to listen. He could treat his head like G. Day or R. Lentz, clueless noise. He hadn't quite gotten this before now, how it wasn't just a matter of writing out the cravings for a substance. Everything unendurable was in the head. Was the head not abiding in the present, but hopping the wall and doing a recon and then returning with unendurable news you then somehow believed? If Gately got out of this, he decided, he was going to take the Knievel picture off his wall and mount it and give it to Joelle. And they'd laugh, and she'd call him Don or the Bimster, etc. Gately rolls his eyes way over to the right to see Joelle again, who, she's using both pale hands to get the big book open on her sweatpants lap. Gray window light shines on clear plastic sheets like little laminates inside the thing.
Idea to haul this out last night and was looking at it. I wanted to show you my own personal daddy, she says. She's holding the photo album out at him, wide open, like a kindergarten teacher at story time.
Gately makes a production of squinting. Joelle comes over and rests the big album on the top of Gately's crib railing, peering down over the top and pointing at a snapshot in its little square sleeve.
Right there's my daddy.
In front of a low white porch railing, a generic, lean old guy with lines around his nose from squinting into sunlight, and the composed smile of somebody that's been told to smile. A skinny dog at his side, half in profile. Gately's more interested in how the shadow of whoever took the photo is canted into the shot's foreground, darkening half the dog. And that's one of the dogs. A pointer that got hit right after that by a UPS truck out to 104, she says. Well, no animal with a lick of sense would think it had business being. My daddy never names dogs. That one's just called the one that got hit by the UPS truck. Her voice is different again. Gately tries to abide in seeing what she's pointing at. Most of the rest of the page's pictures are of farm-type animals behind wooden fences, looking the way things look that can't smile, that don't know a camera's looking. Joelle said her personal daddy was a low pH chemist, but her late mother's own daddy had left them a farm, and Joelle's daddy moved them out there and jick-jacked around with farming, mostly as an excuse to keep lots of pets and stick experimental low pH stuff in the soil. At some point in here, an all-business nurse comes in and fucks with the IV bottles, then hunkers down and changes the catheter receptacle under the bed, and for a second, Gately likes to die of embarrassment. Joelle seems not even to be pretending not to notice. And this right here is a bull we used to call Mr. Man. Her slim thumb moves from shot to shot. The sunlight in Kentucky looks bright yellower than New England's. The trees are a meaner green, and have got weird mossy shit hanging from them. And this right here is a mule called Chet that could jump the fence and used to get at everybody's flowers out along Route 45 till Daddy had to put him down. This is a cow. This right here is Chet's mama. It's a mare. I don't recollect any kind of name except Chet's mama. Daddy let her out to neighbors that really did farm to sort of make up for folks' flowers. Gately nods studiously at each photo, trying to abide. He hasn't thought about the wraith or the wraith dream once since he woke up from the dream where Joelle was Mrs. Waite as a maternal death figure. Next life's Chet's mama. He opens his eyes wide to clear his head. Joelle's head is down, looking down at the open album from overhead. Her veil hangs loose and blank again, so close he could reach his left hand up and lift it if he wanted. The open book she's moving her hand around in gives Gately an idea he can't believe he's only having now, except he worries because he isn't left-handed, which is to say, sinistral. Joelle's got her thumb by a weird old sepia shot of the ass and hunched back of some guy scrabbling up the slope of a roof. Uncle Lum, she says. Mr. Riney. Lum Riney, my daddy's partner over to the shop, that breathed some kind of fume at the shop when I was little, and got strange. And now he'll always try and climb up on top of shit if you let him. He winces at the pain of moving his left arm to put a hand on her wrist to get her attention. Her wrist is thin across the top, but oddly deep, thick-seeming. Gately gets her to look at him, and takes the hand off her wrist, and uses it to mime writing awkwardly in the air, his eyes rolling a bit from the pain of it. This is his idea. He points at her, and then out the window, and circles his hand back to her. He refuses to grunt or moo to emphasize anything. His forefinger is twice the size of her thumb, as he again mimes holding an implement and writing on the air. He makes such a big, slow, obvious show of it because he can't see her eyes to be sure she gets what he's after. If a halfway attractive female so much as smiles at Don Gately as they pass on the crowded street, Don Gately, like pretty much all heterosexual drug addicts, has, within a couple blocks, mentally wooed, shacked up with, married, and had kids by that female, all in the future, all in his head, mentally dandling a young Gately on his mutton joint knee, while this mental Mrs. G bustles in an apron she sometimes at night provocatively wears with nothing underneath. By the time he gets where he's going, the drug addict has either mentally divorced the female and is in a bitter custody battle for the kids, or is mentally, happily still hooked up with her in his sunset years, sitting together amid big-headed grandkids on a special porch swing modified for Gately's mass. Her legs in support hose and orthopedic shoes still damn fine. Barely having to speak to converse, calling each other mother and papa, knowing they'll kick within weeks of each other because Neither could possibly live without the other. It's how bonded they've got through the years. The projective mental union of Gately and Joelle Madame Psychosis Van Dyne keeps foundering on the vision of Gately knee-dandling a kid in a huge blue or pink-bordered veil, however. Or tenderly removing the spongy clamps of Joelle's veil in moonlight on their honeymoon in Atlantic City and discovering just, like, one eye in the middle of her forehead. Or a horrific Churchill face or something.
350.
So the addictive, mental, long-range fantasy gets shaky. But he still can't help envisioning the old ex with Joelle well-veiled and crying out, "And lo," in that empty, compelling way, at the moment of orgasm. The closest Gately'd ever come to exing a celebrity was the ragingly addicted nursing student with the head-banging loft, who'd borne an incredible resemblance to the young Dean Martin. Having Joelle share personal, historical snapshots with Gately leads his mind right over the seconds wall to envision Joelle, hopelessly smitten with the heroic Don G, volunteering to bonk the guy in the hat outside the room over the head and sneak Gately and his tube and catheter out of St. E's in a laundry cart or whatever, saving him from the BPD finest or federal crew cuts or whatever direr legal retribution the guy in the hat might represent, or else selflessly offering to give him her veil and a big dress and let him hold the catheter under the muumuu and sashay right out while she huddles under the covers in impersonation of Gately, romantically endangering her recovery and radio career and legal freedom, all out of a Liebenstadt-type consuming love for Gately. This last fantasy makes him ashamed. It's so cowardly. And even contemplating a romantic thing with a clueless newcomer is shameful. In Boston AA, newcomer seducing is called 13th stepping.
351.
And is regarded as the province of true bottom feeders. It's predation. Newcomers come in so whacked out, clueless and scared, their nervous system still on the outside of their bodies and throbbing from detox, and so desperate to escape their own interior, to lay responsibility for themselves at the feet of something as seductive and consuming as their former friend, the substance. To avoid the mirror AA hauls out in front of them, to avoid acknowledging their old dear friend, the substance's betrayal and grieving it, plus, let's not even mention the mirror and vulnerability issues of a newcomer that has to wear a UHID veil. One of Boston AA's stronger suggestions is that newcomers avoid all romantic relationships for at least a year. So somebody with some sober time, predating and trying to seduce a newcomer, is almost tantamount to rape, is the Boston consensus. Not that it isn't done, but the ones that do it never have the kind of sobriety anybody else respects or wants for themselves. A 13th stepper is still running from the mirror himself. Not to mention that a staffer seducing a new resident he's supposed to be there to help would be dicking over Pat Modisian and Ennett House on a grand scale. Gately sees it's probably no accident that his vividest Joelle fantasies are coincident with flight from finest and legal responsibility fantasies. That his head's real fantasy is this newcomer helping him avoid, escape, and run, joining him later in, like, Kentucky on a modified porch swing. He's still pretty new himself, wanting somebody else to take care of his mess, somebody else to keep him out of his various cages. It's the same delusion as the basic addictive substance delusion, basically. His eyes roll up in his head at disgust with himself and stay there. I went down the hall to take out the tobacco and brush my teeth and rinse out the spiritine can, which had gotten an unpleasant crust along the sides. The subdorm halls were curved and had no corners as such, but you can see at most 3 doors and the jamb of the 4th from any point in the hall before the curve extrudes into your line of sight. I wondered briefly whether it was true that small children believed their parents could see them, even around corners and curves. The high winds moan and doors rattle were worse in the uncarpeted hall. I could hear faint sounds of early morning weeping in certain rooms beyond my line of sight. Lots of the top players start the AM with a quick fit of crying, then are basically hale and well-wrapped for the rest of the day. The walls of the sub-dorm's hallways are dinner mint blue. The walls of the rooms themselves are cream. All the woodwork is dark and varnished, as is the galoche that runs below all ETA ceilings, and the dominant odor in the hallways is always a mixture of varnish and tincture of benzoin. Someone had left a window open by the sinks in the boys' room, and a hump of snow lay on the sill, and on the floor beneath the window by the sink on the end, whose hot water pipe shrieks, was a parabolic dusting of snow, already melting at the apex. I turned on the lights, and the exhaust fan kicked on with them. For some reason, I could barely stand its sound. When I put my head out the window, the wind came from nowhere and everywhere, the snow swirling in funnels and eddies, and there were little grains of ice in the snow. It was brutally cold. Across the east courts, the paths were obscured, and the pines' branches were near horizontal under the snow's weight. Schitt's transom, an observation tower, looked menacing. It was still dark and snow-free on the lee side facing ComEd, the sight of distant ATH-SCME fans displacing great volumes of snowy air northward is one of the better winter views from our hilltop. But visibility was now too poor to make out the fans, and the liquid hiss of the snow was too total to make out whether the fans were even on. The headmaster's house wasn't much more than a humped shape off by the north tree line. But I could picture poor C.T., at the living room window in leather slippers and Scotch plaid robe, seeming to pace even when standing still, raising and lowering the antenna of the phone in his hand, with several calls out already to Logan, MIA Dorval. WeatherNet 9000's recorded update, heavy-browed figures in Quebec's ONANTA office, CT's forehead a washboard and lips moving soundless as he brainstormed his way toward a state of total worry. I brought my head back in when I could no longer feel my face. I made my little ablutions. I hadn't had to go to the bathroom in a serious way in 3 days. The digital display up next to the ceiling's intercom read, 11:18, Eastern Standard Time, 0456. When the whap-whap of the bathroom door subsided, I heard a quiet voice with an odd tone farther up around the curve of the hallway. It turned out that good old Ortho Stice was sitting in a bedroom chair in front of a hall window. He was facing the window. The window was closed, and he had his forehead up against the glass, either talking or chanting to himself very quietly. The whole lower part of the window was fogged with his breath. I came up behind him, listening. The back of his head was that shark belly gray white of crew cut so short the scalp shows through. I was more or less right behind his chair. I couldn't tell whether he was talking to himself or chanting something. He didn't turn around even when I rattled my toothbrush in the NASA glass. He had on his classic darkness wear, black sweatshirt, black sweatpants, on which he'd had a red and gray ETA silkscreened down both legs. His feet were bare on the cold floor. I was standing right beside the chair, and he still didn't look up. "Who's that now?" he said, staring straight ahead through the window. "Hi, Orth." "How? You're up kinda early." I rattled my toothbrush a little to indicate a shrug. "You know, up and about." "What's the matter?" "What do you mean?" I asked. "Your voice. Shoot, are you crying? What's the matter?" My voice had been neutral and a bit puzzled. "I'm not crying, Orth." "Well, then." Stice breathed onto the window. He reached up without moving his head and scratched the back of his crew cut. "Up and around. We going to play some foreigners out there today or what?" For the past 10 days, I'd always felt worst in the early AM before dawn. There's something elementally horrific about waking before dawn. The window was unobscured above the darkness's breathline. The snow wasn't swirling or pummeling the window, as much on the building's east side, but the lee side's absence of wind showed just how hard new snow was coming down. It was like a white curtain, endlessly descending. The sky was lightening here on the east side, a paler gray-white, not unlike Stice's crew cut. I realized that from his position he could see only condensed breath on the window, no reflections. I made a few grotesque, distended, pop-eyed faces at him behind his back. They made me feel worse. I rattled the brush. Well, if we do, it's not going to be out there. It's drifting about up to the tape on the west nets. They'll have to try to get us indoors somewhere. Stice breathed. There's no indoor places got 36 quarts, Inc. Winchester Club's got 12 is maybe the most. Fucking Mount Auburn's only got 8. They'll have to move us around to different sites. It's a pain in the ass, but Stitt's done it before. I think the real variable will be whether the Quebec kids got into Logan last night, before whenever it was this hit. Logan will be shut down, you're saying. But I think we'd have heard if they got in last night. Freer and Strzok were keeping tabs on an FAA link ever since supper, Mario said. Boys are looking to get X'd by some slow-witted, hairy-legged foreign girls or what? My guess is they're stuck up at Dorval. I'll bet CT is on the case even now. Get some sort of announcement at breakfast, probably. This was a clear opening for the darkness to do a quick CT impression, wondering aloud over the phone to the Quebecois coach whether he, CT, should press for them to charter ground transport from Montreal, or else, rather, urge them not to risk travel through the concavity in a storm, in such a generous but disappointed gesture. The Quebecois would think busing the 400 clicks to Boston in a blizzard was his own generous idea. CT wholly opening all different psych strategies to the coach's inspection, with a frantic ruffling sound of the coach's French-English dictionary loud in the phone's background. But Stice just sat there with his forehead against the glass. His bare feet were tapping some sort of rhythm on the floor. The hallway was freezing, and his toes had a faint blue tinge. He blew air out of his lips in a tight sigh, making his fat cheeks flap a little. We called this his horse sound. Were you talking to yourself out here, or chanting, or what? A silence ensued. Heard this one joke, Stice said finally. Let's hear it. You want to hear it? I could use a quality laugh right now, Dark, I said. You too? Another silence ensued. Two different people were weeping at different pitches behind closed doors. A toilet flushed on the second floor. One of the weepers was nearly skirling, an inhuman keening sound. There was no way to tell which ETA male it was, which door back down past the wall's curve. The darkness scratched the back of his head again without moving his head. His hands looked almost luminous against the black sleeves. There's these three statisticians gone duck hunting, he said. He paused. They're like statisticians by trade. I'm with you so far. And they gone off hunting duck, and they're hunkered down in the muck of a duck blind for hunting, in waders and hats and all, your top-of-the-line Winchester double-aughts and so on. And they're quacking into one of them kazoos duck hunters always quack into. Duck calls, I said. There you go. Stice tried to nod against the window. Well, and here comes this one duck come flying on by overhead. Their quarry, the object of their being out there. Damn straight, they're raising debt, and what have you, and they're getting set to blast the son of a whore into feathers and goo, Stice said. And the first statistician, he brings up his whinny and lets go, and the recoil goes and knocks him back on his ass, curse splat in the muck, but he's missed the duck, just low, they saw. And so the second statistician, he up and fires in, and back he goes too on his ass too. These whinnies got a fucker of a recoil on them. And back on his ass the second one goes, from firing, and they see his shot goes just high. Misses the duck as well. Misses her, just high. At which, and then the third statistician commences to whooping and jumping up and down to beat the band, hollering, "We got him, boys! We done got him!" Someone is crying out in a bad dream and someone else is yelling for quiet. I wasn't even pretending to laugh. Stice didn't seem to expect me to. He shrugged without moving his head. His forehead had not once left the cold glass. I stood next to him in silence and held my NASA glass with a toothbrush and looked out over the top of Stice's head through the window's upper half. The snowfall was intense and looked silky. The East Court's pavilion's green canvas roof bowed ominously down, its white Gatorade logo obscured. A figure was out there, not under the shelter of the pavilion, but sitting in the bleachers behind the East Show Courts, leaning back with his elbows on one level and bottom on the next, and feet stretched out below, not moving, wearing what seemed to be puffy and bright enough to be a coat, but getting buried by snow, just sitting there. It was impossible to tell the person's age or sex. Church spires off in Brookline were darkening as the sky lightened behind them. The beginning of dawn looked like moonlight through the snow. Several people were at their vehicles, windshields with scrapers down along Commonwealth Avenue. Their images were tiny and dark and fluttered. The avenue's line of buried parked cars looked like igloo after igloo, some sort of Eskimo tract housing thing. It had never before snowed like this in mid-November. A snow-covered B-train labored uphill like a white slug. It seemed clear that the T would be suspending roots before long. The snow and cold sunrise gave everything a confected quality. The portcullis between the driveway and the parking lot was half up, probably to keep it from being frozen closed. I couldn't see who was in the portcullis's security booth. The attendants always came and went, most of them from the Ennett House place, trying to recover. The flagpole's two flags were frozen and stuck right out straight, turning stiffly from side to side in the wind, like someone in a neck brace instead of flapping. The ETA physical post mailbox just inside the portcullis had a mohawk of snow. The whole scene had an indescribable pathos to it. Stice's fogged breath kept me from seeing anything closer than the mailbox and East Courts. The light was starting to diffract into colors at the perimeter of Stice's breath fog on the window. Shocked heard that joke down at the cranial place, from some BU fella with just terrible facial pain, he said. Stice said. I'm going to go ahead and ask the question, D-Man. It's a statistics joke. You got to know your medials. Means and modes. I get the joke, Orth. The question is, how come you've got your forehead all up against the window like that, when your breath's keeping you from seeing anything? What are you trying to look at? And isn't your forehead getting kind of cold? Stice didn't nod. He made his hoarse sound again. He had always had the face of a fat man on a fit man's lean body. I hadn't noticed before that he had an odd little teardrop of extra flesh low down on his right jowl, like a bit of skin with mole aspirations. He said, "The forehead stopped feeling cold a couple hours back, when I lost all my feeling in it." "You've been sitting here with bare feet and your forehead against the glass for a couple hours?" "More like four, I think." I could hear a night custodial crew laughing and clanking a bucket right below us. Only one was laughing. It was Kinkle and Brant. "My next question's pretty obvious then, Orth." He gave another awkward shrug that didn't involve his head. "Well, it's sort of embarrassing here, Ink," he said. He paused. "It's, stuck, is what it is."
"Your forehead stuck to the window?"
"Best as I can recollect, I wake up. It's just after 0100. Fucking coils having them discharges again. And there's no sleeping through that, boy." I shudder to think, Orth. "And coil, of course, just doesn't even hit the light, just hauls out a fresh sheet from the stack under his bunk and goes right back to sawing logs. And I'm wide awake by this point in time, though. And then I couldn't get back under."
"Couldn't get back to sleep?"
"Something's real wrong, I can tell," the darkness said.
"Pre-fundraiser nerves? The Whataburger coming up?"
You feel yourself starting to climb plateaus, starting to play the way you came here hoping one day to play. And part of you doesn't believe it. It feels wrong. I went through this. Believe me, I can under... Stice automatically tries to shake his head and then gave a small cry of pain.
Not that. None of that. Long fucking story. I'm not even sure I'd want anybody to believe it. Forget that part. The point's, I'm up there. I'm lying there real sweaty and hot and jittered. I jump on down and got a chair and bring it out here to sit where it's cool.
And where you don't have to lie there and contemplate Coyle's sheet slowly ripening under his bunk, I said, shuddering a little.
And it's just starting to snow then, out. It's about maybe like 0100. I thought how I'd just sit and watch the snow a little, and settle on down and then go grab some sack down in the VR.
He scratched at the reddening back of his scalp again. And as you watched, you rested your head pensively against the glass for just a second.
And that was all she wrote.
Forgot the forehead was sweated up. Whammo. Ka-twanged my own self. Just like, remember when Raider and them got Ingersoll to touch his tongue on that net post last New Year's? Stuck here fucking tight as that tongue, Hal. Hell of a lot more total stuck area, too, than Ingersoll. He only did lose that smidgen off the tip.
Ink, I tried to pull her off her about 0230, and there was this fucking sound. This sound and a feeling like the skin'll give before the bind will, sure. Frozen stuck. And this here's more skin than I care to say goodbye to, Buddy Ruff.
He was speaking just above a whisper.
Jesus. And you've just been sitting here all this time? Well, shit, I was embarrassed. And it never got quite bad enough to yell out. I kept thinking if it gets a little worse, I'll go on and yell out. And then along about 03, I quit feeling the forehead altogether.
You've just been sitting here waiting for someone to happen along, chanting quietly to keep up your courage.
I was just praying like hell it wouldn't be Pimulus. God only knows what that son of a whore to thunk of to do to me here, all helpless and immobilated. And Trolch is sawing logs just inside that door there with his fucking mic and cable and ambitions. I've been praying he don't wake up. And let's don't even mention that son of a bitch Freer.
I looked at the door. But that's Axe Handle's single. What would Trolch be doing sleeping in Axe Handle's room? Ortho shrugged.
Trust that I've had plenty of time to listen and identify different folks' snores, Ink.
I looked from Stice to Axford's door and back. So you've just been sitting here listening to sleep noises and watching your breath expand and freeze on the window, I said. Imagining it seemed somehow unendurable. Me just sitting there, stuck, well before sunrise, alone, too embarrassed to call out, my own exhalations fouling the window and denying me even a view to divert attention from the horror. I stood there horrified, admiring the darkness's ballsy calm.
There was a kind of real bad half hour when my upper lip up and got stuck too in the breath, when the breath froze. But I breathed the sucker loose. I breathed real hot and fast, goddamn near hyper-V'd. I was scared if I passed out, I'd slump on forward and the whole face would get stuck. Goddamn forehead's bad enough.
I put my toothbrush and NASA glass down on the cantilevered vent module. Room's vents were recessed, hallway vents protrusive. ETA's annular heating system produced a lubricated hum I had stopped really hearing years ago. The headmaster's house still had oil heat. It always sounded like a maniac was hammering at the pipes far below.
Dark, prepare yourself mentally, I said. I'm going to help pull you loose.
Stice didn't seem to hear this. He seemed oddly preoccupied for a man occlusively sealed to a frozen window. He was feeling at the back of his head with real vigor, which is what he did when he was preoccupied.
You believe in shit, Hal?
Shit?
I don't know. Little kid shit. Telekinipsion, ghosts, para-abnormal shit.
Just going to get around behind you and yank and we'll pop you right off, I said.
Somebody did come by before, he said, There was somebody standing back there about maybe an hour back, but he just stood there. And then he went away. Or it.
A full body shiver.
It'll be like that last little bit of ankle tape.
We'll pull you back so hard and fast you won't feel a thing.
I'm getting these real unpleasant memories of that piece of Ingersoll's tongue on Nine's net post that stayed there till spring.
This is no saliva at sub-zero metal situation, Dark. This is some freakish occlusive seal. Glass doesn't conduct heat like metal conducts heat.
There ain't too fucking much heat involved in this window right here, Buddy Ruff.
And I'm not sure what you mean, paranormal.
I believed in vampires when I was small. Himself allegedly used to see his father's ghost on stairways sometimes, but then again, toward the end, he used to see black widow spiders in his hair, too, and claimed I wasn't speaking sometimes when I was sitting right there speaking to him. So we kind of wrote it all off. Orth, I guess I don't know what to think about paranormal shit.
Then, plus, I think something bit me. On the back of the head here, some bug that knew I was helpless and couldn't see.
Stye stuck again at the red area behind his ear. There was a kind of weltish bump there. It wasn't in a vampire-related area of the neck. And good old Mario says he's seen paranormal figures, and he's not kidding, and Mario doesn't lie, I said. So, belief-wise, I don't know what to think. Subadronic particles behave ghostishly. I think I withhold all prejudgment on the whole thing.
Well, all right, then. It was good it was you come by, then.
The big thing's going to be to stiffen the old neck, Dark, to avoid whiplash. We'll pull you off there like a cork from a bottle of Moet.
Pull my sorry ass off here, Ink, and I'll take and show you some para-abnormal shit that'll shake your personal tree butt good, Stye said, bracing. Ain't said nothing to nobody but Lyle about it, and I'm sick of the secretness of it. You won't pre-formulize any judgments, Ink, I know.
You're gonna be fine, I said. I got right behind Stice and bent slightly and got an arm around his chest. His wooden chair creaked as I braced my knee against it. Stice began breathing fast and hard. His paratitic jowls flapped a little as he breathed. Our cheeks were almost pressed together. I told him I was going to pull on the count of three. I actually pulled on two, so he couldn't brace himself. I pulled back as hard as I could, and after a stutter of resistance, Stice pulled back with me. There was a horrible sound. The skin of his forehead distended as we yanked his head back. It stretched and distended until a sort of shelf of stretched forehead flesh, half a meter long, extended from his head to the window. The sound was like some sort of elastic from hell. The dermis of Stice's forehead was still stuck fast, but the abundant loose flesh of Stice's bulldog face had risen and gathered to stretch and connect his head to the window. And for a second I saw what might be considered Stice's real face, his features as they would be if not encased in loose, jowly prairie flesh. As every millimeter of spare flesh was pulled up to his forehead and stretched, I got a glimpse of Stice as he would appear after a radical facelift. A narrow, fine-featured, and slightly rodential face, aflame with some sort of revelation, looked out at the window from beneath a pink visor of stretched, spare skin. All this took place in less than a second. For just an instant, we both stayed there, straining backward, listening to the little Rice Krispie sound of his skin's collagen bundle stretching and popping. His chair was leaning way back on its two rear legs. Then Stice shrieked in pain.
Jesus God, put it back!
The little second face's blue eyes protruded like cartoon eyes. The fine little thin-lipped second mouth was a round coin of pain and fear.
Put it back, put it back, put it back!
Stice yelled.
I couldn't just let go, though, for fear that the elastic stretch would snap Stice forward into the window and send his face through the glass.
I eased him forward, watching the chair's front legs descend slowly to the floor, and the tension of the forehead's skin decreased, and Stice's full, fleshy, round face reappeared over the small second face and covered it, and we eased him forward until nothing but a few centimeters of decollagenated forehead skin hanging and sagging at about eyelash level, remained as evidence of the horrific stretch.
Jesus, God,
Stice panted. You are really and truly stuck, Orth.
Fuck me skating, did that ever hurt?
I tried to rotate a kink out of my shoulder. We're going to have to thaw it off, Dark.
You're not getting close to this forehead with a saw, bud. I'll sit right here till spring first, see if I don't.
Then Jim Trolch's towering AM cowlick and then face and fist emerged through Axford's doorway, just over Stice's hunched shoulder. Stice had been right. Being in somebody else's room even after lights out was an infraction. Staying there overnight was too far out even to mention in the regulations.
Reports of screaming have reached us here in the Eyewitness News Center,
Trolch said into his fist.
The fuck out of here, Trolch, Stice said.
Thaw, Ortho. Warm water. Heat the window. Hot water. Dissolve the adhesion. Heating pad. Hot pack from Loach's office or something.
Loach's door can't be dickied, Stice said. Don't wake him up on fundraiser day yet.
Trolch extended the fist.
Reports of high-pitched screams have led this reporter to an unfolding scene of dramatic crisis, and we're going to attempt to get a word with the youngster at the center of all the commotion.
Tell him to pipe down and get back with that hand, or so help me Jesus, Hal.
The darkness accidentally put his forehead against the window here when it was wet, and it froze, and he's been out here stuck all night, I told Trolch, ignoring the big fist he held to my face. I squeezed Stice's shoulder. I'll go get Brant to rig something warm. It was as if some tacit agreement had been reached, not even to bring up Trolch's being in Axford's room or where Axford was. It was hard to know which would be more disturbing, Axford's not being in his room all night, or Axford being in there behind the ajar door, meaning Trolch and Axford had both spent the night in one small single with exactly one bed. The universe seemed to have aligned itself so that even acknowledging it would violate some tacit law. Trolch seemed oblivious to any appearance of impropriety or unthinkable possibilities. It was hard to imagine he'd be this obnoxious if he felt he had something to be discreet about. He was standing on tiptoe to see over the window's breath line, one hand cupped over his ear, as if to hold a headset. He whistled softly.
Plus, in addition, now reports of mind-boggling snowfall are coming into the news center.
I grabbed my toothbrush and NASA glass from the vent's protrusion. Since the Battelle caper, only the worst kind of naïf leaves his toothbrush unattended around ETA.
352.
Keep an eye on Stice and my NASA glass right there, Jim, if you would.
Any comment on the mixture of pain, cold, embarrassment, and weather-related feelings you must be feeling? Mr. Stice, is it?
Don't leave me immobilated with Trolch, man, Hal. He's going to make me talk to his hand.
A weather-related drama unfolding around the original plight of an embarrassed man trapped by his own forehead,
Trolch was saying into his fist, facing his own reflection in the window, trying with the other big hand to quash the cowlick as I trotted and slid to a stop in my socks just past the door to the stairwell.
Kenkel and Brant were ageless, in the special desiccated way janitors are ageless, somewhere between 35 and 60. They were inseparable and essentially unemployable. Boredom had years ago led us to lateral Alice Moore's minimally crypto-protected employee files, and Brant's file had listed his SBIQ as submoronic to moronic. He was bald and somehow at once overweight and wiry. Both right and left temples carried red, jagged surgical scars of unknown origin. His effective range consisted of different intensities of grin. He lived with Kenkel in an attic apartment in Roxbury Crossing, overlooking Madison Park High School's locked and cordoned playground, famed site of unsolved ritual mutilations in the year of the Purdue Wonder Chicken. His major attraction for Kenkel seemed to consist in the fact that he neither walked away nor interrupted when Kenkel was speaking. Even in the stairwell, I could hear Kenkel discoursing on their Thanksgiving plans and directing Brant's mop work. Kenkel was technically black, as in negroid, though he was more the burnt sienna color of a spoiled pumpkin. But his hair was a black person's hair, and he wore it in thick dreadlocks that looked like a crown of wet cigars. An academic diamond in the very rough Roxbury Crossing, he'd received his doctorate in low-temperature physics from UMass,